You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. iwoca.co.uk.
Where are we, Lionel?
We're in the People's Republic of Tooting, Richard, in your home office, surrounded by wall to ceiling, almost a cycling book library in here.
Actually, that only one bookcase contains cycling books, Lionel. Left to right, we've got sports books over there, fiction behind you, cycling, and non-fiction here.
And Harry Potter over there.
And still to read over there. That's my still to read.
The complete works of Oscar Wilde, still to read.
I mean, I haven't read the complete works. I've read one or two bits of that. Where's Daniel?
Well, Daniel is on the road at Paris-Nice, somewhere between Paris and Nice.
Brilliant.
We assume that he's having a fairly surreal time. We'll hear from Daniel in the third part.
We're going to hear from Daniel a bit later on with the latest from Paris-Nice. We're speaking after the first two stages, which have been absolutely brilliant, belting stages, lots of entertainment, and, you know, slightly surreal because we're in the midst of a period of great uncertainty in bike racing and in all other things, really. Paris-Nice is on, it feels like a stay of execution in a way. Strada Bianche has fell by the wayside. Milan-San Remo will not be held. Tirreno Adriatico will not be held. Italy is the most severely affected country in Europe by coronavirus at the moment. But we imagine that, well, I spoke to a team doctor yesterday who described it as a rolling epidemic. And so other races, other countries may well be affected in the coming weeks. We'll see.
Well, yeah, the area just not far from Compiègne, where Paris-Roubaix starts next month, is currently experiencing a sort of mini lockdown, not too different to how it was in Milan sort of 10 days ago. So, as you say, a kind of this whole epidemic is, it's a bell curve, isn't it? And different countries and different regions are at different stages. You would have to think that Italy is experiencing, hopefully, the worst of it, and will come through the other side in the coming days and weeks. But
We'll hear from our good friend Ciro Scognamiglio, who is in Milan, works for Gazzetta dello Sport, of course. So he's in the middle of that at the moment. We'll hear a bit from him later in the episode. Have you got news, though, Lionel? I mean, there's lots of news, some very sad news.
Lots of news, yeah. Well, if you listened to last week's podcast, you will have heard Richard introducing the podcast with the very sad news that Nicolas Portal, the sports director of Team Ineos, had died at the age of just 40 from a heart attack. Really shocking news, this, as, well, stunned everybody in Team Ineos and everyone who really has had any kind of contact professionally or personally with Nicolas Portal in the world of cycling. His funeral was held in the southwest of France on Monday. We'll talk a bit about Portal's life and career in the final part of today's podcast.
We will, and we'll hear from Theo Gegenhart, who sent us in a tribute, I suppose, to his sports director, with a couple of stories in there remembering Nicolas Portal. But Theo got in touch and wanted to contribute something to our memories of Nicolas Portal, so we'll hear from him in the final part.
Very sad news for the world of cycling, and a very big loss. And another significant figure that the world of cycling has lost in the past week is Ron Webb, the master track builder, a very accomplished Australian rider in his own right, built Olympic tracks in Seoul, Sydney, Athens and London, also built the track in Manchester and Newport, which lots of our listeners may well have had a ride on. He insisted on every nail being hammered in rather than a nail gun being used, because he wanted the tracks to be built with a certain precision. He was 87 years of age. He actually raced 6 days, had a decent career as a track rider, and ran the Skoll 6 day at Wembley, which I think started in 1969 and ran through the 70s. His talent initially was for building temporary tracks that could be put up and taken down for 6 days in non-cycling arenas, and from that he became, well, the leading expert on constructing indoor tracks. So Ron Webb, his legacy is that he built those tracks that all of those gold medals were won on in all of those Olympics. As you say, Richard, races being cancelled. Strada Bianca in Italy was called off at the weekend, as was the Grand Prix Industria e Artigianato. Daniel's not here to correct my pronunciation on that. Tirreno Adriatico is off. That would have been starting tomorrow, but that's off. And Milan San Remo is off, as is the Women's World Tour race, the Trofeo Alfredo Binda, the Coppi Bartali stage race, the Giro di Sicilia stage race. And, well, that takes us up to the start of April. After that, we really don't know, and we don't know what implications the coronavirus will have on the Giro d'Italia, which starts in Hungary in May. The intention is to reschedule all of these races. The Trofeo Alfredo Binda is going to be held in June, all being well. Strada Bianca, Tirreno Adriatico and Milan San Remo may well be held at the end of October after Il Lombardia, which could mean the World Tour season ending with the Poggio and Via Roma on the 31st of October. That is the plan that's been mooted so far. So it's going to be a very strange season, no matter what happens.
And what if Strada Bianca in particular, it has quite a good slot on the calendar already, but, you know, what if it finds a new home? You know, what if it's a roaring success later in the year?
The first year it was held in the autumn,
that's
wasn't
right,
it?
Yeah.
And then
yeah.
it moved to the spring for the second edition, and it's been held in the spring. Yeah, it could well be, couldn't
I mean,
it?
There's that fantastic, you know, the autumn classics in Italy are great races. It gives a real nice, it's almost a nice little postscript to the season. I don't know. I mean, who knows? Let's just hope that they are held at all. Maybe give Philippe Gilbert a better chance of claiming his fifth monument, Milan-San Remo, in October. Who knows?
Well, somebody could do the Il Lombardia Milan San Remo double in the space of a few weeks, couldn't they? We could have the race of the falling leaves followed a week later by the race of the flying gravel. I mean,
I like it.
Anyway, it's certainly a very strange time. Paris-Nice has gone ahead, but without several of the biggest teams. Mitchelton Scott have pulled out. Astana, Jumbo-Visma, CCC, Movistar and UAE Team Emirates have all pulled out because of the coronavirus. Team Ineos pulled out partly because of the death of Nicolas Portal, but also with concerns over the health of their riders. As we speak, Paris-Nice is ongoing. Whether it makes it all the way to Nice, I mean, we're again into speculative territory there. As you say, it's been a cracking first couple of days racing. The wind has really blown, and some riders have excelled in those conditions. The first stage was won by Max Schachmann. Earlier on, we'd seen Julian Alaphilippe and Thijs Benoot away, but then another little group came to the fore, and Schachmann won the sprint ahead of Dylan Teuns to take the leader's yellow jersey. Nairo Quintana was one of the riders, one of the GC riders, who excelled as the race split to pieces in the crosswinds, but Quintana missed out on the second stage as a result of a crash. Julian Alaphilippe also had a puncture, so he lost a bit of ground. On stage one, I should just mention, the French champion Warren Barguil hit the deck. Quite a strange sequence of events, because he got back on his bike and then pulled over to the side of the road looking like he might abandon. And then when the Arkea Samsic sports director noticed that they were being filmed by the TV, Barguil was persuaded to get back on his bike and ride. He was more than 5 minutes down at the time. Subsequently, he was disqualified for spending too long in the slipstream of a car. So not a great day for Barguil there. Stage two, won by Giacomo Nizzolo of NTT.
He pickpocketed Bora Hansgrohe there, didn't he?
I certainly did.
Set up, you know, they had Sagan there, they had Pascal Ackermann there, they had Schachmann there. They had real strength and numbers in that front echelon. And you would have thought it was Ackermann's for the taking, but Nizzolo just snatched it on the line. A real smash and grab job, but what a cracking stage that was. I mean there was some wonderful footage of side on footage, I think taken by a helicopter, just showing the moment where Stefan Kung was trying to get Thibaut Pinot back towards the front, Pino turning himself inside out trying to stay on Kung's wheel, lost the wheel. And in contrast to that, tiny little Sergio Higuita being taken through the echelon by Sepp van Marck, his teammate, who was really looking after him and kept looking around checking he was still there. Not easy to see, I wouldn't have thought, for Sepp van Marck's very big, Sergio Higuita's very, very small, but it was just brilliant footage, just right in the middle, in the guts of the of that echelon, and riders looking for shelter from the wheel behind, and yeah, great. I could have watched a lot of that, and I've watched it several times.
Sergio Higuita, I mean, he's the best Higuita to come out of Colombia since René Higuita, the Colombian goalkeeper who, you'll remember, Richard, being a keen watcher of the England football team. I think it was in 1995, a shot from Jamie Redknapp going towards goal, and René Higuita did what was described as a scorpion kick, so basically flipped his legs back behind him to clear the ball off the line. Quite spectacular. I'm no doubt you'll find that on YouTube if you want to work out what it and what on earth I'm talking about. But Sergio Higuita looks really well placed to challenge as the stages get hillier and more to his liking and as the week goes on.
And Vincenzo Nibali, the shark, lurking there. A late call up to Paris-Nice. He was going to ride Tirreno Adriatico, but he's looked fantastic as well the first couple of days.
It's funny, isn't it, with all of the biggest GC teams missing, the fact that the peloton is slightly reduced, but the teams are back up to 8-man teams. Would have been 7 normally, but because of the coronavirus and the withdrawals, the teams have been bumped up to 8. It's not felt like a reduced spectacle at all in the first 2 days. Quite the opposite, in fact. I was speculating to myself yesterday whether I was watching it so keenly because it might be the last bike race we see for a little while.
Well, it's not an ideal situation, obviously, but the first couple of stages have been great, and the weather obviously is a factor in that as well. When you have crosswinds like that, it does create chaos and exciting bike racing. So yeah, it's been great, and as I say, we'll hear from Daniel a bit later on.
Sticking with the impact that coronavirus has had on the professional peloton, well, teams were still stranded in the UAE until just a couple of days ago. Cofidis and Groupama FDJ were allowed to leave.
Gazprom and UAE Team Emirates are still there. I spoke to Jeroen Swart, the head of medicine at UAE Team Emirates. He's one of the people under quarantine there. I spoke to him in his hotel yesterday, and they're coping okay with the, he said the first few days were the hardest, but the riders now have turbo trainers. Most of them are doing 2 training sessions a day, and they seem to have got into a sort of rhythm, but they are hoping to get home at the end of this week.
Zwift has really come into its own for the riders, hasn't it? Arno Demart and David Godu were among the riders that took part in a race on Zwift. For those who don't know, it's virtual cycling. Well, it's real cycling, isn't it? But on static bikes on a computer game. Everyone must know what Zwift
Everybody
is.
Knows
everyone
what Zwift knows what Zwift is,
yeah. Mitchelton Scott's riders also pretty active on Zwift over the weekend. Is it too late to organise Milan San Remo on Zwift?
Is this the next few weeks of the podcast, Lionel? Zwift updates?
Well, who knows what the next few weeks are going to bring. I mean, we're going to let's not speculate on what will or won't be, because we just don't know. Governments at the moment don't know. The measures that have been put in place in Italy have been on the face of it extreme. The Serie A has been suspended, that's the football league. I mean, professional football does not get cancelled lightly, so that should give us an indication of how seriously it might affect cycling. But until events are declared to be on or off, we really don't know. Well, we'll hear from Daniel in part 2 of the podcast. He will be able to give us an on-the-ground update of what it's been like at Paris-Nice. Must have been pretty surreal. First of all, they said that fans would be discouraged from gathering at the stage starts and finishes. Obviously, on the first day, that more or less fell on deaf ears because the crowds were as large as you would expect. But then stage 2, the finish straight, there was nobody there at all. In fact, everyone was kept at least 150 metres away from the finish line. Every time we cough here, Richard, we're there's a slight raising of the eyebrows. I hope we're not going to end up quarantined in your office.
Oh, well, there are lots of reading material. No toilets, unfortunately.
Indeed. There was a strange story regarding the Groupama FDJ rider, Bruno Amirail, who developed a cold on the final day of the UAE tour and was taken to hospital, wasn't allowed to leave, tested negative several times, and in the end decided to take himself off to the airport and flew home. The rest of the Groupama FDJ riders were met by Mark Maddio, their team boss at the airport, with who he brought some pancakes. And champagne.
Yep. Mm-hmm. And the unluckiest man was also Tim Kerrison, who had flown, and I just heard this story recently, the coach at Team Ineos had flown in for the last couple of days of the UAE tour, arrived just an hour or so after news of coronavirus broke on the race itself, and found himself in quarantine for a couple of days, having not seen any bike racing at all.
Some other news is that the Hammer Series has been suspended by Velon. They've pulled the plug on it temporarily. It's part of their ongoing dispute with the UCI. The UCI objected to them using the word series in the Hammer Series, which, I mean, we'll talk about this maybe as the weeks go on, because it seems like a not the sort of battle the UCI should really be picking. You know, the Hammer Series is... Well, it's adding something to the calendar, whether you like it or not. It's been very popular with some people, hasn't it? And just to sort of the circumstances that have led to its suspension are not don't reflect terribly well on the UCI, I wouldn't have thought. A news story that one of the Spanish newspapers had is that the Astana riders have not been paid in full for the last couple of months. Alexander Vinokourov, the team boss, says everything's fine and that the money will be coming in and everyone will be paid. But that's, again, another slightly strange story that a seemingly big, well-established and well-backed team is not managing to pay their riders on time. And finally... we mentioned Oleg Tinkoff last week. He has now been charged with tax fraud in the US. Allegedly, he concealed $1 billion worth of assets when he was renouncing his US citizenship in 2013. And he is under lockdown in Holland Park. We'll wait and see what that means. I mean, he's not involved in cycling anymore, but he was a larger-than-life character for a few years, wasn't he? A couple of races that I should mention as well. Hugo Hofstetter of Israel Startup Nation won Le Samin, which finishes in Dour. Richard.
Why are you looking at me for that?
Just the Scottish pronunciation Dour. Of the word dour.
Yeah.
Dour.
Oh, did you say dour?
I would say dour.
Hmm.
A bit dour. A bit dour. And Fabio Jakobsen.
Dour rhymes with Moore.
Moore. Richard Moore, as we say in England. Fabio Jakobsen won the Grand Prix Jean-Pierre Montserrat in Roeselare in Belgium. If you're ever in Roeselare, it's where Jean-Pierre Montserrat was from. He won the World Championships in the mid-70s in Leicester and then tragically was killed in a while in a race.
1970, wasn't it?
The following year. It was 1970, sorry, yeah. And was killed the following season, was hit by a car in a race in Belgium. And the cycle route around the Roeselare is named after Jean-Pierre Montserrat and has the little rainbow bands on it. I talked about this in the Lionel of Flanders series a few years ago, and I follow quite a lot of that route on two wheels. It's if you're ever over in Flanders with your bike, it's a nice route to take. Now, slight corrections corner, Richard, because last week you said that Jasper Stuyven was not from Flanders because he was from Leuven.
Yeah.
Jasper Stuyven from Leuven. Well, Leuven is in Flanders.
I actually realised that evening, didn't I? I messaged you in a panic because I realised that evening that... Because I was in Leuven last year for Brabantse Peel, and it was while I was there that I learned that Leuven, although it seems to be the wrong side of Brussels for Flanders, it is in Flanders.
You would have thought that the Lionel of Flanders would have picked you up on that, but, well, I was on holiday last week, Richard, and wasn't really listening.
You're listening to the Cycling Podcast, brought to you by iWalker. Flexible loans built for small businesses. Join 50,000 customers taking on life's twists and turns and scaling new heights with iWalker. If you run a business, find out more at iWalker.co.uk. iWOCA.co.uk.
Yes, thank you very much indeed to our new title sponsor, iWalker, who we introduced in last week's podcast. We expanded a bit on how our relationship with iWalker came about in the newsletter as well. Some of you have subscribed to the newsletter. Do sign up at thecyclingpodcast.com if you want to get a, a weekly kind of behind-the-scenes story about what's going on at the podcast and upcoming things. Last week, I talked about how the association with iWalker came about, and we'll expand on that in the podcast over the coming weeks and months, I would think.
Yeah, just on the newsletter, first of all, we obviously let everyone know that episodes are out that they can download and what's coming up for Friends of the Podcast, for example. But we just thought this year we'd take turns to write something a little bit more personal about something else that's going on. It might be why we chose to tell a particular story, or what we're working on, or how we intend to fill the coronavirus gap, maybe, if there is one. If you haven't signed up for the newsletter, do so at thecyclingpodcast.com.
And if you want to find out a bit more about iWalker, go to iwalker.co.uk. That's iwoca.co.uk. But they're a business finance company. They loan money between £1,000 and £250,000 to small businesses. And their support of the Cycling Podcast, well, it's given us stability over the next year. We'll be able to provide all the usual coverage and enhanced coverage, because thanks to iWalker's sponsorship, we have been able to relaunch Explore, which first ran as a six-part mini-series at the end of 2018. We've been looking at ways of bringing it back and settled on making it a monthly show. So episode one came out last week to mark our new relationship with iWalker. And episode one was thoroughly entertaining, Lionel.
It was my conversation with Felicity Cloak, who wrote a really engaging book called One More Croissant for the Road. Basically, she combined the spirit of Henri de Grange with the essence of Elizabeth David. She went on two wheels around France, seeking out some of the French classics, and not the bike races, the culinary classics. And it was something that really appeals to me. Two of my great loves are cycling in France and French food.
Not necessarily in that order.
Certainly not in that order. No. But what I wanted to do with there's going to be plenty of stories about the real kind of hardcore cycling exploits. But I wanted to just re-establish that Explore is not just about cycling solo around the world or taking on superhuman challenges, although there will be plenty of that. I wanted to really establish that the whole series is about the relationship between people and the bike and the countryside, wherever they may be in the world.
And Ian Boswell's part of the Explore team, so is Hannah Troop. We heard from Ian and his transition to gravel racing this year as he retires from the World Tour, and he'll be popping up in each episode of Explore, I believe, Lionel. So lots to look forward to with Explore. But we've been enjoying watching Pyrenees, and we will catch up with Daniel a little bit later on. But cracking first couple of stages, some really eye-catching performances. One that caught my eye was Tesh Banut, who's joined Team Sunweb. And, you know, he was somebody who came up through Lotto Soudal, and I don't know why, but you would have thought he would stay with that team. He seemed like a good fit. A very talented rider, almost too versatile. There's too much he can do for him to really narrow down and focus on something in particular. But he's ridden well at Tour of Flanders. He won Strade Bianche a couple of years ago. He goes very well when the weather's bad. He's a tough rider, a real kind of old school rider. And we caught up with him at the Sunweb team launch, or Orla Shinawee did on our behalf, just before Christmas. And a couple of things he said in that interview with her were quite interesting in light of his performances this week in Pyrenees. And here he is explaining also why he made the move from Lotto Soudal to Team Sunweb.
It's been a busy day for you today. I've been trying to grab a word for about 90 minutes now. You've been surrounded by media. What's it been like?
Yeah, I think it's normal. I'm new in the team. A lot of Belgian press here who follow my steps here, first steps in the new team. So, it was a busy day, like you say, but I enjoyed it so far.
First steps in a new team, as you say, how does that feel? Do you feel like you're stepping out of your comfort zone slightly?
Yeah, exactly what I also wanted to do. Feels a bit like a first day to school again. All new people, new ways of doing things. Yeah, it's something I like, some change from time to time, and that was a moment for me after 5 years Lotto Soudal, and I really feel like it's the right moment to change things. Yeah.
What was the motivation? What was the primary factor for changing? As you say, you've been there since 2015. Yeah. Many thought it was a natural fit. You may stay there for the rest of your career. Why did you decide to make the move, and why now?
I want to refresh my mind a bit, like you say, step out of my comfort zone. And also, in my opinion, what I thought was like to make a next step forward. I had the biggest chance to do it here in this team. So that's why I made the choice, just career-wise. I chose for what I was thinking was the best step in my career, and also was the first time I was end of contract with Lotto Soudal. So it was the first time I could be on the market, to ride the market. So
During the team presentation, I noticed there weren't many specific goals laid out for next year. Was that a deliberate policy to not tie your colours to the mast, so to speak?
I don't know, actually, because I was not on stage. They didn't talk to me about
good
it.
Good get out.
Yeah. But it's true, the team is really team-oriented or something like this. For sure, every rider has his own personal goals, and I think we will talk about it next week on training camp. We have time for some longer talks with the coaches, trainers. I have my goals, like everyone, I think.
What can you tell us about those goals? What does your gut feel for 2020?
I came here also to improve my 1 week stage racing, but I think they can really improve my time trial. And then they have more experience with stage races. This will be more for the second part of the season. For the first part of the season will be like a big block from opening weekend in Belgium till Liège, Bastogne-Liège. And in between we have to discuss which races to do and not to do, because it's a long block, so you need to balance well. I think it's possible with a good balance, and I think also the team can support me in this really well. But for sure, will be like the biggest one day races in professional cycling will be my biggest goal: Flanders, Liège, Amstel. Like races.
A classic win, then, really.
Yeah. Since my win in Strade Bianche 2 years ago, or last year in 2018, I think my season has only succeeded when I have a big win. Yeah.
Best of luck with it. Thank you.
Thank you. You're welcome.
So that was Teish Banoot talking to Orla Shinoui about his reasons for moving to Sunweb, and also mentioning that week-long stage races would be one of his focuses. And I was interested in the crosswind stage on stage two, how much effort Sunweb put into sending men back to try and get him back up to the front group. He'd finished up there on stage one, of course. He was away with Julian Alaphilippe for a long time. But the sort of support that he got suggested to me that Sunweb regard him, and they left Michael Matthews isolated in the front group in order to support Banoot, suggests to me that they see him as a real leader, rather than just at Lotto Soudal he was one of several cards that they could play, rather than a rider who necessarily had the whole team supporting him. It seems like his role at Sunweb might be quite different.
Yeah, Sunweb's a funny one. I mean, I made a quip, not when we were recording, but you know, the sense that Sunweb had lost Tom Dumoulin, and therefore almost like a supermarket that had been ransacked and stripped of all toilet roll in the grip of a coronavirus.
Tom Dumoulin toilet roll.
Oh, goodness, that was unintentional. But actually, when you look at the Sunweb roster, there's a lot of talent in isn't there? You know, not just Banoot and Matthews, but Søren Krogh Andersen, who rode so well at Omloop Het Nieuwsblad. Who else is in there?
Case Ball,
yeah.
And already a winner this
powerful
year.
Sprinter. And lots of riders that can provide sort of strong backup. But you're right, I think Banoot will get opportunities in Sunweb that he may well not have got at Lotto Soudal, simply because Lotto Soudal would go to stage races with probably slightly different ambitions and objectives.
Absolutely. Anything else caught your eye? I mean, Quintana, unfortunate on stage two. He looked to be riding extremely well, as he has been doing so far this season. Sergio Higuita, definitely. Max Schachmann, I think, just confirming his promise. Interesting to see the role that Sagan has there as a real team man. You know, he's been part of a very successful team the last couple of years, but there haven't been many occasions where he's been in a race and having to ride in the service of somebody else. And it's almost like with Ackermann there and Schachmann, he's been acting as a sort of super domestique.
Yeah, he just drifted off the front a bit yesterday, didn't he? And was clearly doing just a bit of probing and just policeman work rather than looking to get away himself. It's really difficult to weigh up, you know, how impressive these performances are because there are so many absentees. I mean, in a way, we're kind of seeing teams come to the fore that perhaps wouldn't have so much impact in a stage race like Paris-Nice, because you would normally expect the likes of Ineos, Jumbo-Visma would have been there with Primoz Roglic, UAE would have been there with Tadej Pogacar, Movistar always have somebody, Astana always have somebody, Mitchelton Scott would have had somebody contending. So it's really difficult to weigh up, but take nothing away from the performances so far. And really, what has been appealing about it has been the full-on racing. We haven't seen two stages of Paris-Nice. We've seen two classics, really. On the first day, there was even a little cobbled climb. So the wish for the wind to blow is out of the hands of the race organisers, but there's nothing more exhilarating, is there, in the early season than seeing the peloton split up into groups, and then gradually that information comes through from the TV commentators about who is in which group. The first two stages, somebody has missed out each day. And on stage two, it was slightly disappointing to see both Alaphilippe and Quintana concede time through no fault of their own. A crash for Quintana and a puncture for Alaphilippe, because I felt that over the course of the week, I mean, well, Quintana's been sparkling so far this season, and I would have thought he would be among the favourites. But now, well, we'll just have to see what happens over the remainder of the race. We've got, of course, a fairly significant time trial. Not terribly long, is it, the time trial on stage four? It's only 15 kilometres. But, you know, that's enough to shuffle the pack a little bit before the climbing starts over the weekend.
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport. Fueled by science.
My name's Chris Hoy. I'm a six-time Olympic gold medalist and an 11-time world champion. 92, it was very basic indeed. Basically, maltodextrin, you know, using carbohydrate mixed up with water. That was your fuel source. For endurance rides and for sort of recovery after our sessions, protein for sprinters. So the endurance riders wouldn't use protein because they thought that if you had a scoop of protein, you were going to get muscles like Arnold Schwarzenegger. But then creatine came out. So 1992, creatine came out. That was a new super wonder product, again, for power athletes as opposed to endurance athletes. And Science and Sport, one of the first companies to produce this creatine monohydrate. So yeah, that was, I mean, it was expensive. It was about 20 quid a tub. Back then, and that as a student, that was a lot of money. But you know, we decided, well, this is a product worth using. So yeah, Science and Sport has been a company I've used, I've trusted since then, and even in my retirement now, I still use their products. And yeah, I think when you become an ambassador for a company, you only do it if you truly believe in what the company stands for and the products. And yeah, I certainly do with Science and Sport.
Thank you very much indeed to Science and Sport, our long-term supporters, and we're very grateful to them for that support. And they're still offering 25% off all your Science and Sport products at scienceandsport.com with the code SISCP25. That's SISCP25 at scienceandsport.com. Great to hear from Daniel, of course, but we have got a few more things to talk about in this week's episode. The very sad passing of Nicolas Portal, of course, but just on coronavirus a little bit more and its threat to the racing. Obviously, Italy is the epicenter of that at the moment, and our friend and colleague Ciro Scognamiglio is in Milan, and obviously stuck there for the moment. So he had been due to go to the UAE tour. It's the first time he's not been to that race. He didn't go. But his season has been interrupted as everybody else's has. So I caught up with Ciro last night. Here he is speaking from, his office in Milan.
Ciro, where are you? Tell me where you are.
Well, dear listeners, I'm in Milan right now. So far from the sea and unfortunately in the center of a really difficult situation, well, for the world, but mainly, well, for Italy in this moment, unfortunately.
Are you at home, Ciro?
No, I'm now I'm in my in my office at the newspaper. At the newspaper now.
So you're. I mean, how does the how does it affect things in life in Milan? I mean, what are the rules about where you're allowed to go and you know?
Yeah. Well, certainly, the social life, if we can define this, it's certainly restricted. There are a lot of limitations now in Milan, in all the Lombardy, in the and not only in other the part of Italy. Maybe the main restriction, well, apart from the fact that the schools will be closed till the 3rd of April so far, but there are no theater, no cinema, not dancing, it's not possible, and restaurant and bar will be open only from 6 a.m. To 6 p.m. So if I just to explain really well to our listeners, in Milan, in North Lombardy, it's not possible to go out for dinner, for example, not at all till the 3rd of April.
So, I mean, Ciro, does that mean you have to cook for yourself?
Well, Richard, actually not, because as our listeners know really well, I have a lot of friends in Milan. Friends of the podcast, but not only friends of the podcast. So I can go dinner if I want with them in their apartment, or for example, when I do my takeaway for lunch, at the same time in the same place, I can also have the takeaway for dinner, and so I can survive, dear Richard.
That's a relief, Ciro. I mean, have you been affected by the illness itself? Have you seen it at close quarters? Are people scared? You know, when you see somebody coughing or showing signs of being unwell, is there a sense of paranoia? I guess is what I'm asking.
Well, now I mean a little bit, yes. Maybe I mean till last week. Maybe the situation was a little bit, I don't know, undervalued, or the sensation was not of a danger, but so far in my area, in Milan, well, yes, there is a little bit of this sense now in our life. For example, another measure of this can be taken by the underground, for example, of the public transports, in which for sure there are less people than the normal. As a matter of fact, Milan, you have to imagine Milan as more or less in August, when maybe the majority of people is outside for holidays. Now it seems more or less like this situation, but unfortunately not because the most of people is in holidays, but the fact that the majority of people tries to remain at home.
And Ciro, of course, the bike races upcoming have been postponed. I mean, how bad is that for RCS? Because, you know, they're maybe not as wealthy as ASO, but how well equipped are they to deal with the cancellation of those races?
Well, certainly, I mean, it has been another decision, but as a matter of fact, the decision was has been taken for the special measure taken by the government for this health emergency. And certainly, for RCS, has been really tough, but for sure, the company will try when hopefully the situation will be more will be safer. Hopefully, certainly it's difficult to understand now when, but the hope is that the situation can come back to the normality, as a matter of fact, in the second part of the year. And so for sure, RCS will try to organize the races Strade Bianche or Tirreno Adriatico, Milan Sanremo, the races of this period that we'll try to organize maybe in June or maybe more likely after August. It's a question mark for the moment, but it's 100% that LCS will do everything to try to organize races in this year.
And Ciro, any fears for the Giro at all, or are people quite confident that it'll have passed by then?
Well, difficult to say, because nobody can know really well what can be the evolution of the coronavirus diffusion in Italy and all over the world. It's almost 2 months, exactly more or less 2 months for the start of the Giro, and certainly the hope is that everything can be done smoothly, but so far it's really difficult to have a prediction about this. Just speaking for a while, seriously, I mean, in my opinion, it's important to remain optimist, to try to follow really well the rules of this period of emergency, and then I'm confident that everything can be solved. And Richard, as you know, that we have to arrive as usual at the end of the year to organize our live show, but also before, I'm confident that we could organize something together.
I hope so, Ciro. I hope so. I certainly look forward to, you know, seeing you again at a bike race. I'll know things are back to normal.
It's my same hope. You say, if I'm not wrong, in Great Britain, keep our fingers crossed really well.
Keep your fingers crossed and keep them well washed, Ciro. You better go and wash your hands now.
Exactly. Very, very often.
Okay, Ciro, good luck, and I hope we speak to you soon and see you soon.
See you soon. Thanks a lot.
Thank you, Ciro.
So a little insight there from Ciro into what life is like in Milan. When you hear stories from the quarantined area, which now includes the whole of Italy, people, you know, seem to be coping just fine individually. And I mentioned I've spoken to Jeroen Swart, the head of medicine at UAE Team Emirates. The reality, you know, for him, stuck in a 5-star hotel in Abu Dhabi, is fine. I think he said, as I mentioned earlier, the first few days were the hardest, but they've got into a sort of rhythm, and he's catching up with a lot of work and so on. But he did mention that a fear and maybe a factor in his team withdrawing from racing was that if not to denigrate French hotels too much, but if you were quarantined in a hotel in the middle of France, it wouldn't be quite the same as being in a 5-star hotel in the Middle East.
No, I think there's, I mean, we talked about this last week, and obviously I'm not an expert on a pandemic, but I can see that as I kind of tried to explain in last week's podcast, the concern really globally is the strain that lots of people getting ill at the same time would place on health services, and really, you know, that's kind of the thing that is paramount. And that was one of the main reasons why EF Pro Cycling pulled out of Strade Bianche. I think they were the first team to say they weren't going to go to race in Tuscany, and
just about 48 hours after Jonathan Vaughters had very enthusiastically welcomed the fact that it was apparently going on.
Well, I think it's natural, isn't it, to all think business as usual, let's crack on. You know, it's affecting relatively small numbers of people. You know, the demographic of people who are most likely to be seriously ill is, it's a small portion of the population, probably. But I think a virologist gave him some hard information about
credit to him for changing his mind or changing his mind in the light of stuff that he learned that he hadn't previously known. And I think we're all learning about that, because I'm the same. I'm divided down the middle of thinking, on the one hand, you know, it seems odd that life can't just go on as normal. But then on the other hand, when you learn about the impact on the health services in particular, what's happening is extreme, but it does make sense, and it is working in other parts of the world.
Well, Mitch Docker rides for EF Pro Cycling. I spoke to him last night because we've got the next episode of Life in the Peloton coming out a little bit later this week. And he was due to ride Strada Bianca for the first time. He was really looking forward to taking part in the event, but was basically glad that the matter was taken out of his own hands. Because, well, as we've seen, anyone returning back home from Italy after the weekend would now be in a really difficult position of thinking, well, do I need to self-isolate and keep myself away from potentially vulnerable people, particularly as a kind of the incubation period for the illness is, they say now, 5 days. So you could go quite happily through life for 5 days, not realizing that you had the virus and pass it on. And that's how it spreads so
although
rapidly,
apparently,
isn't it?
You can't pass it on in those first 5 days. You can't pass on until you have the symptoms. No, but I mean, you're hearing, this is what I heard on the radio this morning, that you're not infectious in those first 5 days. But
either way, the concern would be that if you travelled into Italy and then came home, that there would be some doubt about whether you would then, you know, who knows? I mean, other objectives might be further compromised down the line. I think from the point of view of professional cycling, yeah, it's a real shame that we've lost Milan San Remo particularly. Let's hope that does get rescheduled at the end of the season. But if we lose more classics as a result of this, I would much rather that the world kind of got on with the job of containment and got through it quicker so that we can get back to normal sooner. The worry from the point of view of the Grand Tours is that if this drags on to the end of April, then you start looking at whether or not the Giro d'Italia is in any danger of taking place.
Well, for what it's worth, Jeroen thought that the Giro would be okay because if you look at China and South Korea, still new cases in South Korea, but the trend is that going down and the pattern appears to be quite encouraging, and if Italy follows the same trajectory, then the Giro should be okay, and the fact that it hit hardest and first in Italy could be a blessing for the Giro. But we're into the realms of pure speculation. We do not know. All being well, we should be through it in sort of mid to end of April, and the Giro starts in Hungary in early May and doesn't reach the north of Italy for, you know, 10 days or so after that. So fingers crossed the Giro will be fine, but we are into the unknown here, and anything we say about it is pure speculation.
The podcast will go on though, won't it?
Oh, there's lots we can do on the podcast, Lionel. Don't worry, we could even if we end up quarantined ourselves, we could still podcast, I'm sure. I'm out here in my, you know, I could be isolated here for a couple of weeks, I'd be fine, I think. Like I say, lots to read.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car, the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour at the Tour de France, to remind us to tell you that this episode is sponsored by Lacca. Now, Lacca is a community of cyclists all working together to insure their bikes and equipment in the event of damage or loss, and ensuring that the premiums are lower and the payouts in the event of a claim are swifter. You'll be dealing with people who really understand what they're insuring. They won't be fazed by expensive bikes. They won't be fazed by the names of bikes and group sets and whatever it is you want to cover. And you pay a premium depending on the value of the bikes, equipment and so on that you want to cover. But don't just take our word from it. Let's hear from one of Lacca's happy customers.
Yeah, so I'm Nathaniel Rosa. I live just north of London, and I've been a Lacca customer for about 2 months. Funnily enough, Lacca are actually a client of mine. I'm a video guy, and I've produced some videos for them. And it kind of just seemed, I mean, it was just obvious that I would then become a customer of theirs, just because I saw their model from the inside and out, and it was just an obvious choice. So the thing I liked really is that essentially they're incentivized to pay as opposed to incentivized to find ways to not pay. It relieves all stress from, first of all, from the process of claiming, but also just knowing that you're protected and the company isn't going to try and wiggle out from it. I imagine if I was with someone else, that would actually be a worry, but it's just not a worry. So that's a big positive in my opinion. I had a crash in Calpe while out on a training camp at the beginning of February. I came down fairly hard. I wasn't going very fast, but it was a hard hit. And yeah, I had to claim for helmet and parts on the bike as well. So actually the process was really simple. You go on their website, you log in, you click claims, and essentially you upload a short video of yourself explaining what happened. You write in a comment box what parts are damaged and what needs to be replaced, and pretty much hit send, and that's pretty much it. And you get an answer within a few hours, actually. Everything that I'd put on the insurance policy, which in this case was everything that had got damaged, was covered, yeah, and they had no problems sorting it all out. I sent a video showing all the damage, and yeah, it was pretty simple. So I took my bike into my local bike shop to get them to do a quote to show everything that was damaged, and we sent that via the online chat system as a PDF, and in about an hour they had bank transferred the money to the bike shop to then order the stuff. So literally an hour. Pretty impressive, actually. Yeah, even the bike shop has said they'd never dealt with an insurance company that had been that proactive and that quick ever.
So if that sounds like the sort of insurance you would like for your bikes and equipment, then go to laka.co.uk. That's laka, laka.co.uk.
Well, I've been joined by Daniel Freib, Daniele Fribarancini. Daniel, you're in France, in at Paris. Where exactly are you?
Good question, Rich. We're sort of in the breadbasket. We're near Montluçon, so it's just south of Bourges. Yeah, I'm not in a very good mood, Rich, because I've just been kicked out of my hotel room, which is not as rock and roll as it sounds. What I mean by that is that, you know, had a hotel room booked for a couple of months, and then phoned up to book a table for dinner at the hotel tonight, and the hotelier cheerily announced they'd given my room away because, you know, we hadn't been in touch for a few weeks.
It's not all glamour, is it, Daniel?
No, it's not. So
we're three stages in now. Lionel and I convened earlier and talked about the first couple of stages, but today, it wasn't a fast stage, was it today, but quite eventful, a few crashes. And I don't know if you can shed any light on what happened at the end. I mean, the stage was won by Ivan Garcia Cortina from Bahrain McLaren. Very powerful sprint in the end ahead of Peter Sagan. But Sam Bennett seemed to become detached from his lead-out train, who just seemed to give up on him. And then he was left on his own and ended up crashing into the barriers.
Yeah, Rich, I'm not sure whether he lost his lead-out train. When I was watching it in real time, my impression was that he'd seen a better option on his inside, and he'd sort of jumped aboard that train, thus sort of relieving Morka being his lead-out man, of his sort of duties. But of course, by going inside, that was what got entangled up with what ended up being a pretty nasty crash. So, I mean, the good news is I've just heard that he has had 4 stitches in one of his fingers, but he's going to carry on tomorrow. So, nothing broken. He seems okay.
Well, the racing has been really good the first 3 days. Daniel, we were talking about that, Lionel and I, about how entertaining it's been in this sort of surreal atmosphere. I mean, it's been surreal watching it. What's it like being on the race itself?
Well, the racing has been really good, and, you know, it's paradoxical because if you sort of drew a 200-kilometre radius circle around Paris, you get sort of the most boring, nondescript landscape in France, but you tend to get really good racing, actually. We've seen that in Tour de France before, and we've seen it in other races, and it's because the roads are very exposed to crosswinds, notably, and at this time of year, of course, you get terrible weather, or you can do, and it's often the case at Paris that it's cold and wet, and it has been the last few days. Beyond that, obviously, everyone's talking, thinking about coronavirus. It sort of feels as though the plug could be pulled at any moment on the race. That said, I heard today that Nice and the city of Nice have had some misgivings about particularly the starts of the weekend. There are two stages that are starting in pretty built-up areas in Nice. The finish on Sunday is not scheduled from the Promenade des Anglais, the traditional finish in Nice. It's actually due to finish by the football stadium, which is kind of out of town. So that wasn't so much of a concern. But the two starts in Nice were causing some headaches for the organisers. But today, as things stand today, so on Tuesday, the Nice, so the top, the prefecture in Nice, is that word in English, Rich? That's mm-hmm. kind of the word in French. The top boys in yeah. Nice have given the green light as things stand. But, you know, the situation is very fluid, isn't it? It's changing all the time. But as far as the riders are concerned, I mean, I think they're also sort of uncertain about how not only this race is going to pan out, but of course the season beyond this. I spoke to one of the Italians in the race, Bonifazio, this morning, and he was very unsure about whether he was going to be able to get home, whether he was going to be able to leave home once he got there, and whether he would look into sort of arranging some kind of training camp somewhere else. But everyone is sort of making it up as they go along.
I mean, that's the thing. There are a few Italian riders there. Sage Baniessi, of course, and Vincenzo Nibali is there. I mean, they must be concerned about, you know, friends, family at home, but also about whether they don't all live in Italy, of course, but travel there. I mean, I spoke, since I recorded with Lionel earlier, I spoke to the Team Ineos Dr. Richard Usher, and, you know, some of the Italian contingent weren't able to attend the funeral of Nicola Portal on Monday. Restrictions are so tight there. So it's having a huge impact on, obviously, everyday life, but for professional athletes, it must be very difficult, very challenging time.
Yeah, I mean, as far as the training is concerned, I mean, that's been sort of directly addressed, you know, the sort of circumstances of a professional athlete and the fact that they need to train outdoors, and that I think there was some text in the I don't know whether it's a decree they're calling it issued by the Italian government, but basically the situation, as I understand it, is that they can train as normal, but they need some kind of form or self-certification with them, and they need their racing license. And you know, they're also, I mean, one of the main issues, one of the main reasons that I think the Italian government has felt the need to sort of specify what they should do, professional athletes, is that of course they can crash on training rides and they can need hospital care and they can need medical care, and you know, that would obviously put even more strain on the a healthcare system in Italy, which is struggling to keep up.
What's your impression, Daniel, of ASO, the organisation there? They must be very conscious of the fact they're taking quite a big risk holding the race at all. What's your sense of, I saw your interview with Christian Prudhomme on ITV, but what's your sense of their state of mind at the moment?
Well, I think as we anticipated a week or so ago when we discussed the issue and we talked about insurance policies and financial implications, they're very much, the organisers are very much deferring to the government and happy to defer to the government, which, yeah, it strikes me is probably the right thing to do, not least because, you know, the experts on this are working for the government and not for ASO. It's, you know, whether the measures they're taking will have any significant impact on you know, risk and whether the virus could spread, for example, keeping people just slightly further away, not significantly really further away from the podium areas and keeping them outside of the last 100 metres of stages, whether that's going to have any major impact, or sorry, last 300 metres of stages, I think. I don't know, but it's what they've been told to do, and at the moment, the relevant authorities are happy for the race to go on. You know, there are some slightly paradoxical situations here. You're getting teams, some teams, and barring McLaren, EF Education, have forbidden any interviews. There are other teams that have tried to institutes some kind of policy, and so the riders are sort of doing their own thing. Lotto Soudal have stopped doing interviews, but Philippe Gilbert is very happy to talk to the press at any time. There are other teams, RKS Samsic are insisting we take the microphone, the hood off the microphone when we're doing the interviews with them. That at the same time, you know, we're not allowed to interview Bahrain McLaren riders, not allowed to interview EF Education riders, but we stayed in the same hotel as them last night, and we're dining in the same dining room and, you know, using some of the same facilities as them. So it is a little bit odd, the situation, in many respects.
Well, we'll obviously watch Paris-Nice with interest and hope that it does make it to Nice, and that some of the other races, the classics in particular, can go on. But we just don't know. We're in the hands of medical experts and governments who will hopefully be listening to those medical experts. Lionel, the week has been dominated also by the tragic news last week about the death of Nicolas Portal, who passed away very suddenly at home, aged just 40. Sports director at Team Ineos, of course, former rider. He rode for the Movistar, as they were then, Case Depan, before that AG2R, and spent just a year as a rider with Team Sky. And I got to know him a little bit in his first year at Team Sky, partly because he didn't speak any English at all, and I had to, when I interviewed him in my terrible French, and he was just one of these people who was very helpful and very sort of generous in trying to help me complete my job, rather embarrassingly. And then, of course, over the next few months and years, he became very, very fluent in English, and it continued to be something that he asked me about my French. He was always a very, you know, pleasant guy to see and speak to, no matter what was going on with Team Sky and Team Ineos. And there have been, of course, over the years, some pretty unsavoury stories around the team and subjects that we've had to speak to him and others about. He's never been somebody who would avoid talking about it. His job was quite specific. He was a sports director. He was, you know, at Team Ineos, jobs do tend to be quite specialised. His job was on the road in the team car, deciding on strategy and tactics and speaking to riders, giving them instructions. But no matter how hard a day it had been, he would always stop and speak in great detail. Sometimes you'd only have to ask him one question and then 5 minutes later turn off the recorder, because he would go into great detail about what had happened in the stage and the tactical permutations and so on. So somebody I think all of us only had good experiences with, and that makes it all the sadder, because he seemed like such he didn't seem like someone with a side to him.
No, I think the mark of somebody is how they respond when things don't go well. And on Team Sky, Team Ineos's bad days, he would be as open and as free with his time and his comments as when things were going well. I mean, admittedly, they rarely had particularly bad days at the Tour de France, but I was struck at the Vuelta last year. He didn't make excuses for his riders easily. He didn't sort of the first stage into Calpe, their two team leaders, Wout Poels and Theo Gegenhardt, were both basically dropped on one of the climbs to the finish, and I kind of did one of those open-ended questions, almost making an excuse for them. You know, was it bad positioning that had led them to be caught out? And Portal wasn't having any of that. He said no, it was they weren't good enough on the climb when it mattered. And you know, he didn't duck a tricky question, but he answered with a sort of openness and you know, a warmth. I think that was the main thing about him, wasn't he? He was a very warm character. You know, he'd come out of the bus or come out of the team car at the end of the stage, and he knew that part of his job was talking to the media and trying to shed light on what had happened rather than sort of deflect away questions and criticism.
No, absolutely. We played some clips of interviews that he'd done with us over the years at the start of last week's episode, and it was, you know, as always, it's quite powerful to hear somebody's voice, and I think you hear in his voice the personality. There was an enthusiasm as well behind, I think, what he did and who he was. And somebody who heard that was Teo Gegenhart, the Team Ineos rider, who's ridden for that team for a few years now. So got to know Nicolas Portal very well. And Teo got in touch to say he would like to pay a tribute to his former sports director. And here it is. Here's Teo Gegenhart on Nicolas Portal.
Nico Portal is someone who I'll always be grateful to have met. Even more grateful to have been able to work alongside and really get to know as a person. I think he's the type of person who for the weeks, months and many, many, many years to come will always be in my mind and is someone that I'll always be reminded of. I think sometimes the most poignant dedication is the first thing that you feel when you learn about the loss of someone that you've known well. And what sprung to my mind was that Nico was someone who never failed to have a moment for anyone, whether it be a fan, a journalist, or a bike rider, and the same goes outside of cycling. He's someone who I never met a single person that said a bad word about him, and he really was a true inspiration to me. His energy, humility, and his passion for life shone so brightly. It was a real honour to have worked with Nico Portal, and he's someone that I'll miss immensely. To speak a little bit about Nico, I was listening to the cycling podcast last week and they played an interview with Nico, which was incredibly difficult to listen to. But there was something he said in that interview, which even in that moment of retrospect on someone that we'd worked so closely with in the last years, I heard something and Nico said a phrase which I'd heard him say hundreds if not thousands of times before and would have been insignificant to almost all ears, and that was, if you can say that. I don't know why, but those five words for me just say so much about Nico's personality, about his humility. His English was so good, his Spanish was so good, his French as his mother tongue was impeccable. But no matter what, when he was talking with a bike rider, especially in English, he would always ask if he'd said something correctly, if that was the right expression. One of my favourite things about cycling is the translation of phrases and cycling words that we get to experience from being in such international teams. But with Nico, it went further. He always made you feel like you were important, like your opinion was important. And despite everything that he had achieved in such a short amount of time as a director, he always wanted to know what the riders thought, what their opinions were. Thinking back to the Tour of the Alps last year, it had been an incredibly successful day. And that evening, it transpired it was Nico's 40th birthday. He'd managed to keep it quite quiet throughout the day, it being such a big landmark. But I remember as we shared a champagne toast for the victory of that day and also Nico's birthday, being in awe of how much the man had achieved, not only as a professional bike rider, but in the years afterwards, sat in the car with Team Sky and thereafter Team Ineos. Speaking of cars, Nico loved an analogy of a car when trying to help or even just speak with a bike rider. In the Giro last year, I was suffering not my best of moments after about 10 days and having a heavy crash. And Nico came to my room and in the way that only he could, he started talking about diesel engines and the way that when they just start to fire right and burn off all the particles, they start making, as he described, a ding, 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 ding. This was how Nico felt I was going to progress through the race. Nico is someone who, on the bus, was always enthusiastic, always sharing the latest mountain bike kit or news of his family. In general, he just had an incredible passion and energy for life, and it was an absolute pleasure to have been around that. One final memory is from the Dauphiné a few years ago. Geraint Thomas won the overall GC, and en route to that, we won the team time trial victory. I think Nico saying after that stage that it was the best team time trial he'd ever seen in his life remains one of my proudest moments in cycling. Nico, I think everybody in the team is going to find it incredibly hard to move forward without you, especially in your dear France and the races of Paris-Nice, Dauphiné, and of course the Tour de France that you cherished so dearly. However, I know that we will, because above all else, it's what you would have wanted, and we owe you that, to keep fighting in those big races.
Well, a very warm tribute from Theo Gegenhardt to his sports director, Nicolas Portal, there. You mentioned Portal's racing career. Of course, he did miss most of a season in 2009 with an irregular heartbeat, didn't he? And he retired relatively young. 2010, he raced with Team Sky. 2011, he was part of the, you know, he was kind of groomed into a sports director's role. And one of the first races that he was part of the sports directing team was the 2011 Dauphiné. And I spent that race traveling around with Team Sky. And just at the time, it was, he couldn't speak very good English. I mean, he had some, you know, quite, he could communicate, his English was better than my French, but, you know, he wasn't fluent. I remember the first night in the hotel in Chambéry, we were sitting down to dinner on the team staff table. Of course, all the riders are having food prepared by the chef, but the staff were eating what the hotel was serving up, and we were served a sort of slightly pink leg of meat in a sauce. And a few of the rest of the staff and myself, we were looking at it a little bit nervously, thinking this meat probably shouldn't be pink. And somebody asked Portal to ask the waitress what it was. And the waitress said lapin, which I understood to be rabbit. But Portal mistranslated and said it was chicken. And there was a clanking of cutlery because people were concerned that they might be eating semi-cooked chicken. And, you know, there was a lot of leg pulling and teasing, and Portal took that very well. The following morning, Sean Yates, who was a real sucker for punishment on the bike, announced the night before that he was going to go for a bike ride. Anyone wanted to join him, he'd be setting off at 5:30 to drive to one of the climbs, and they'd ride the climb. I didn't get up and go for that ride, but when Sean Yates came back, he saw Nico and said, "Where were you?" And Portal said, "Well, I was down at 5:33 and Sean said, "Well, we left at 5:30 and Portal sort of, you know, sort of rolled his eyes and laughed. And then there was a day when I was in the team car with Sean Yates, and Nico Portal was driving the second team car, so would have been behind us on the road. Our car came, the convoy we were in came to a very sudden halt. Sean wasn't quite quick enough on the brakes, and we just bumped into the back of the Lotto Soudal car. And Mark Sargent got out in a sort of, you know, mock fury. And we got back on the road driving along, and then the radio came on about 5 minutes later, and it was Portal saying, "Sean, did you have a little bump?" And there was just a sense from that, really, that, you know, he'd integrated into this group and was going to, you know, be part of the sports directing team. But when you look at his record, the times he's been in the car for all of those tour wins, he's almost a kind of a, well, in football management terms, he would be up there as one of the greats. But we don't tend to talk about the contemporary sports directors in the same sort of you know, glowing, glorious terms as, say, Cyril Guimard or, you know, any of the other.
No, I mean, I mentioned earlier, part of the reason maybe for that is that hyper-specialisation in Team Sky and Team Ineos, where Cyril Guimard was the emperor. You know, he was all, you know, all powerful. He was the when you thought about the team, and he was the guy not just driving the car but running the team. Portal's job was pretty specific, but he did have a hand, a big hand, in six Tour de France victories, really from 2013 onwards, with three different riders. And you know, he was pretty close to some of these riders. Pavel Sivakov, one of the young riders at Team Ineos, certainly you know, was identified by Portal. He comes grew up in the same area, southwest of France, and was then identified by him as a great talent and signed to the team. I think he's pretty close to Bernal as well. So you know, there was an interesting line in a piece written by Pete Cousins, Cycling Weekly, a sort of tribute to Portal, where he mentioned that he'd done a long interview with him about tactics for his book Full Gas, and Portal had said that few people ever asked him about tactics, and that sort of pulled me up short, because I thought, you're right, in a sense. We go and speak to you at the end of the stages to ask you what's happened that day, but never really about the philosophy behind it or underpinning it. You know, the you know, what he thinks about strategy and about how races are won, and what's come out in some of the tributes and in the things that people have said about him, and including Theo's words, is how much thinking he clearly did about how to win races. There was, Pete Cousins told the story about the 2013 Tour when Chris Froome was isolated, and he told him to that Movistar was his new team, and he was to ride as if he was riding for Movistar. And he was able to, on that occasion, make a quick decision about what was the best strategy on the road. But, you know, and it's a sad aspect of his passing, as well as the tragedy and the loss to his family, of course. But I think, you know, there was a sharp brain there, he would have been an interesting guy to speak to about the, you know, his sort of approach to racing and his thoughts about tactics. But Nicolas Portal, very sad news indeed, and I'm sure we will be talking about him again in the podcast. I mean, as Theo says, he'll be thinking about him a lot over the coming years. We should wrap things up for this week, Lionel. We'll be returning next week, hopefully with Paris-Nice having concluded successfully, and the racing continuing to be as exciting as it's been so far. Just before we go, you mentioned earlier the newsletter. Do sign up for our weekly newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com. Explorer came out last week. What have we got coming up this week?
Life in the Peloton, Mitch Docker's podcast, in which he sits down with his friend Luke Durbridge, and they talk about the opening weekend and the classics in general, and also answer listeners' questions. And there's some real gems in there, actually. If you've not listened to Life in the Peloton yet and thought, you know, for whatever reason, it's not something for you, well, give it a go, because this is another cracker.
And the latest edition of Service Course came out a couple of weeks ago, and in it, Tom Whalley and Lizzie Banks talk about what the pros are riding in 2020. We've also got our friend special, your conversation with Jani Brajkovic in Slovenia, for friends of the podcast. Sign up as a friend of the podcast.
Please do, at thecyclingpodcast.com/friends. I've been really thank you ever so much to everyone who's taken the time to either email us or send me a message on Twitter about that episode. It's been so nice to hear some praise for the episode. I mean, my part in it really was pretty minimal. It was all about just giving Jani Brajkovic an opportunity to tell his story the way he wanted to tell it. And he goes into quite some detail about struggling with disordered eating, which developed into an eating disorder, and a situation that he thinks that a lot of people in professional sport may well also struggle with. So quite an important subject, I think, and one that he tackled with real kind of sensitivity and openness.
Well, that's all for this week. Thank you very much, Lionel.
Thank you, Richard. Next week, will we be doing the Dungeons & Dragons Milan Sanremo preview?
I don't know.
I'll be...
Who might win it if it was on?
I think I'm going to instruct Julian Alaphilippe to attack just before the top of the Poggio and then descend down to the finish and win.
What I can say is we'll be back with Daniel next week and hear from him about Pioneers. Before we go, just a big thanks from us to some of you who've signed up as friends of the podcast. Your support is very much appreciated. So from me, a big thanks to Brendan Gates, Dan Rodden, Manuel Alonso, John Bradbury, Daniel Constable, Roland Goff, Samuel Hayes, Matt Ashby, Mike Mackay, and Peter Cort.
And a big thank you to Michael Pagano, Clifton May, Judith Kendall-Holmes, Ian Coburn, Ian Sheldrick, Simon Chappell, Manuel Unterlan, Simon Vanelli, John Blight, Amanda Jacker. We're going to have to start asking people to send in the correct pronunciation of some of their surnames.
Well, don't worry, they get in touch if we've said it wrong.
You have been listening to The Cycling Podcast. Subscribe to our newsletter at thecyclingpodcast.com to get all the latest news and special offers delivered straight to your inbox. This episode was edited and produced by Tom Wally.